Timothy Lynch is the director of Cato's Project on Criminal Justice. He wrote a book called After Prohibition, An Adult Approach to Drug Policies in the 21st Century. And a whole bunch of studies that I found on the Cato website, including Hanging On to Liberty in a Post-September 11th World, Breaking the Vicious Cycle, Preserving Our Liberties While Fighting Terrorism, No Confidence, an unofficial account of the Waco incident, We Own the Night, Amadou Diallo's encounter with New York City's Street Crimes Unit, Dereliction of Duty, the constitutional record of Bill Clinton. He has filed amicus briefs with the Supreme Court in civil rights cases. He's written articles all about the Fourth Amendment, gun rights, asset forfeiture, military tribunals, constitutional theory, property rights, the federalization of crime, the militarization of police and their tactics, national ID cards, and most importantly, the drug wars. He's written for the four biggest papers, the LA and New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal. Wow, very impressive. Welcome, Mr. Lynch.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Okay, I guess we should get right to the Patriot Act. After September 11th, Congress, I believe that very same month, passed the Patriot Act, which has gotten quite a bit of attention from the Cato Institute, from you in particularly. Why is that?
Well, we're very concerned about the powers that the Patriot Act confers upon federal law enforcement agencies and our intelligence agencies, and we've got two main concerns about it. First is the manner in which the law was passed, and secondly, the powers that are included in the bill. Attorney General Ashcroft, after September 11th, brought to Congress this Patriot Act proposal, and it's one of these bills that is the size of a telephone directory and is very large, very complicated. And he basically said, look, I want this passed in a few days. And people in the Congress were just stunned because it was such a large, complicated measure. They just don't pass laws that way. And even supporters of President Bush and the Republicans said, look, we're just not going to enact a large, complicated bill in 3 days. So Ashcroft thought he was being reasonable by then saying, well, okay, let's pass it in 2 weeks then. I mean, it was just a really first of all, it was happening right in the aftermath of the attacks. And secondly, they were trying to really rush this thing through. And some people who were concerned about it, first thing they said was that, look, this is such a large bill, it's complicated, but some parts of it are not controversial at all. Why don't we break this down into some smaller parts? Let's pass the provisions. Let's vote on the provisions that everybody thinks are uncontroversial. Let's get them out of the way, and then let's slow this thing down, and let's take a look at the parts of the proposals that are more controversial. Let's slow it down and study them more closely before we vote on them. The Bush administration just resisted that completely. They said, no, we want to keep it one big package, and we want it voted up or down as one big package. And they called it a Patriot Act to try to intimidate anybody that was raising questions about it. And then the second thing that happened was then after that response by President Bush and Attorney General Ashcroft, they were resisting breaking it down into some smaller parts. Then some of us said, well, all right, if this thing needs to be rushed into law so fast, why don't we attach sunset provisions onto it? If you think we need to get rush these powers into law right now, you think it's absolutely necessary, let's at least attach sunset provisions on the Patriot Act so that the law will expire after, say, 2 years. That way, it'll give us an opportunity to study how it's being used, whether the powers are being abused, whether or not they're really necessary. And if it's not, the law expires. And if proponents of the Patriot Act want to pass it again, we'll go through the regular legislative process again. And if these proposals have merit, fine, they'll be enacted back into law. But if they don't have merit, the law will expire, and that will be the end of that. And
so
again,
did the Bush administration agree to that?
They did not. They were very, very insisted upon no sunset provisions whatsoever. Again, even some of the Bush administration supporters on Capitol Hill said, look, you cannot object to these sunset provisions. the very reasonable request that we're rushing, you know, this large bill into law right away. It's, you can't object to these sunset provisions. It's a very reasonable thing to ask for in these circumstances. So we ended up getting some sunset provisions on some parts of the bill, but it was over the objections of the Bush administration and the Justice Department. And even now, they're trying to quietly work with some members of Congress to have those sunset provisions removed so that the Patriot Act will become permanent. And so the whole way in which these new terrorism powers were given to the federal government, the way in which it was done, was very troubling. I mean, there's lots of congressmen who will have told the press that they were not even given an opportunity to read parts of the law. They were just given to them. They just were suddenly, the congressional leadership announced that there was going to be a vote on the Patriot Act, you know, this afternoon, and the members of Congress did not even have the opportunity to read the bill before they voted on it. I mean, this is just, you know, there's a good way to pass law, and there's a bad way to pass law, and certainly in a constitutional republic like America, you would think that our legislators are at the very least reading the things that they're passing into law, stuff that affects you and me and our families and our civil liberties and the Constitution, and yet they're rushing these things into law without even studying them closely. So,
what kind of majorities did it get? I mean, did both parties really support it in both houses?
Yes, unfortunately, the support for the bill was overwhelming in both houses of Congress. There was only a single senator that voted against it, Senator Russ Feingold from Wisconsin. And even there were some newspaper reports that said some senators went up to Feingold after the vote and they said, look, we agree with you. We have serious reservations about this law, too, but we were so worried about voting against something that was called the Patriot Act, that we felt we had to vote for it, even though they privately agreed with Feingold that they were very worried about the powers that they were handing over to the government.
Which just shows the integrity of the average congressman, that they'll go ahead and vote directly against what they think is the right thing to do.
It really does. It's really quite shocking and depressing hearing these reports that first there's members of Congress that are willing to vote for things that they have not read, and then there's others that have read about it. They have heard the objections and concerns that are raised about it, and yet they will still go ahead and vote for it because they're so worried about how they'll be perceived by the public and the voters. I mean, these are guys who have taken an oath to support the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. And, you know, all of the citizens out there, they tend to think that people here in Washington are looking out for their welfare and making sure the Constitution is respected, but it's when you see what's really going on, it's it can be very depressing.
I think I just have one more question on the process of how it got passed. We're so far outside the beltway out here that we really just maybe don't even have a good idea of, you know, if it hadn't been such a rush and such a crisis and the administration had come to Congress with, like you say, a law the size of a phone directory, how long, under normal circumstances, would it take for, say, for example, a subcommittee of the House or Senate and their staff members to really go through a bill like that and really know what's in there before voting on it? I mean, it seems to me like that would take a year, right? Or, I don't know, maybe they got good staffers and they can get it done in 2 weeks? Or
Normally bills do take somewhere between 6 months and a year, or even up to 2 years, because the way the process works is, again, there's two houses of the Congress. There's the Senate and there's a House. And so bills have emerge in both houses and proceed independently in both houses. Like, you might have a senator and a congressman in the House of Representatives who have the same idea, they want to pass the same law, but they have to have it introduced in committees in separate houses of Congress. then the committee has to take that up at some point. They usually have a hearing, and they usually call witnesses who will, you know, either be supportive of the measure or critical of it. And then the committee will have a vote on it, and then they will refer it to the full Senate or the full House. And if it passes those houses, then it is reconciled. If there's any differences between, like, the Senate version and the House version, they have, like, a joint committee that will hash out the differences, and then it will go, and then they'll hash out the differences, and then it'll go back to each chamber. Then the Senate has to pass it, the revised version, and the House has to pass a revised version, and only then does it supposed to get to the desk of the President before he signs it into law, if he agrees with it. Now, some people think, oh my gosh, all the rigmarole, but there's very good reasons for that. We don't want our government just to be passing laws willy-nilly. I mean, every law basically is a restriction of freedom, and so America is all about being a free country, so we want to keep the number of laws on our books down to a minimum if we want to keep our freedom. So there's good reasons to have all these checks and balances in the legislative process. We don't want somebody just to be elected to Congress and start writing his opinions into the law. We want him to have to persuade all of these colleagues in the Congress, at least a majority of them, that his idea is a good idea, that it's necessary, and before his opinions become binding law on 200 million citizens around America.
Is it true, I've read this, I think, two different places, is it true that parts of the bill weren't even written yet at the time it was passed, and that they were adding stuff to it after it had already been signed into law?
Well, there's a couple of things that that's pretty close to it. There were changes being made right up until the last minute of there being a vote. That's why some members of Congress, when they were told that there would be a vote on the terrorism bill, either the next day or later on that day, like they were informed the morning that there was going to be a vote on the anti-terrorism legislation that afternoon, well, then they wanted copies of it right away. You know, that's the responsible thing, to find out what's in the something before you actually have to vote for it or against it. And like I said before, a lot of the members were denied copies of the bill, and they were not given an opportunity to read it. And then there was a vote. There was overwhelming passage in both houses of Congress. Some people voted for it because they just believed it was necessary, but a lot of them voted for it without having the opportunity to study it, and a lot of them were just afraid of how they would be perceived by the voters if they voted against something called the Patriot Act right after we had suffered these horrible attacks on September 11th. But getting back to your question, after there was the vote in both houses of Congress, sometime after, members of Congress moved for what they call technical corrections, meaning that they had rushed so fast with the thing that some corrections were necessary to the legislation. Now, this happens quite frequently in the legislative process, but you have to watch them closely, because normally technical corrections just means that, a technical correction, like maybe there was a date, like an effective date on the law when it was supposed to become effective. They just changed that from, you know, one day to another, or they just changed some technical things. So things are not supposed to be a big difference. But when it came to the Patriot Act, they did try to do some things that were not technical corrections. They tried to basically revisit the whole subject of legislation and try to confer even more power to the government under the guise of technical corrections. You know, you always have to keep your eye on what these people are doing here in Washington, because they really try to pull the wool over your eyes sometimes.
Well, and it's a really good thing for people out here to know that we got people like you keeping an eye on them for us, because most of us don't have the time, the money, or the power, or the inclination to keep that close of an eye on them. So I guess that's what the Cato Institute is for.
That's the way what we perceive to be our mission. We do try to keep an eye on what the government is doing, and we realize that people have lives to lead. You know, people have businesses to run. They've got families to raise, and most people do not have the time to keep an eye on some of the shenanigans that go on here in Washington. So that is, you know, one way that they can try to keep and protect their own liberties and make sure the government is abiding by the Constitution is by supporting groups that they think are doing a good job, and that's what supporters of the Cato Institute tell us. They like what we're doing, and that's why they support us, and we try to, you know, do a good job of keeping them apprised of what the government is doing and trying to bring certain issue to the attention of lawmakers, things that they may not be aware of when we're sometimes invited to testify on the Hill or in some of the published reports that you mentioned at the beginning that we distribute to journalists and members of Congress.
Is it the position of the Cato Institute that the executive branch already had enough power to fight terrorism before the Patriot Act, or was there some legislation necessary, just not this one, or?
We agree with a lot of people who said during the debate over the Patriot Act, the Patriot Act, again, was the size of a telephone directory. I mean, there was lots of ink in there, lots of different proposals. And some of the proposals made sense, but a lot of them did not. So it's hard to speak in generality saying, well, if I do have to generalize, I would say that it was a mistake to pass the Patriot Act. But that doesn't mean there aren't a few things in there that made sense that should have been passed. What I've been stressing over and over again since this Patriot Act experience is that in the future, we should insist that there be no more of these gigantic anti-terrorism legislative packages where they bundle lots of different proposals into one gigantic package and then force people to vote up or down against the whole thing.
Doesn't it do that with all crime bills?
They don't do it with all crime bills, but it is a fairly common legislative tactic, which is profoundly unwise. Why do people oppose breaking it down into some smaller parts and voting on the individual parts? They oppose it because they know that if Congress's attention is focused on one particular part of it, the chances are it may not pass. But if they can take a controversial provision and attach it onto something else that is very popular, then they stand a much better chance of getting that past people and enacted into the law. You know, just over the past two or three weeks, the most popular thing in the Congress over the past few weeks has been this Amber Alert bill. It's something that all the congressmen think is a great idea. So what other congressmen are doing is they're trying to attach unrelated legislative proposals onto this Amber Alert bill. And so it is a fairly common tactic, but if we're serious about, again, keeping an eye on the Bill of Rights and checking this government, making sure it doesn't assume too much power, then this type of tactic should be resisted. And we should say, let's stop cobbling together all these unrelated ideas and packaging them up in one proposal. Let's break them down and vote on these things one by one. If we do that, then unwise, unconstitutional proposals will be far less likely to be enacted into the law if we force the Congress to have more discipline and vote on these things individually.
One of the studies that you offered for the Cato Institute is entitled Breaking the Vicious Cycle, Preserving Our Liberties While Fighting Terrorism. What do you mean by vicious cycle?
What I mean is that America seems to have gotten into this habit of thinking that whenever there's a problem, What we need to do is pass a law to fix that problem. And that's what I meant by the vicious cycle, because when the World Trade Center, when it was first attacked in 1993, within 2 weeks, a New York congressman named Charles Schumer proposed some kind of anti-terrorism bill of 1993. After the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995, the Congress rushed forward with the anti-terrorism bill of 1996. And then when we were attacked on September 11th, 2001, then we had the Patriot Act proposal. And so what my main point in this study was is that, you know, as we've heard in the media, it's kind of been the problem of terrorism and how we respond to it has been kind of been framed in terms of liberty versus security. And because we've been attacked, the idea or the argument we keep hearing is that the lawmakers have to redraw the line between liberty and security. And my point was, what you have to take a long-term view of these things. That's what we do here at the Cato Institute. Not just looking over the next 2 years, but over the next 10, 20, 30 years. Are we going to keep redrawing this line between liberty and security every time that we're attacked? Because if we do, if we respond, go through this vicious cycle of passing anti-terrorism laws after every single attack, you can see where we're going to be after 20 years, 30 years down the road. If we keep redrawing that line, eventually we're not going to have any freedom left. So if we're serious about freedom in America, keeping our constitutional liberties, we have to break this vicious cycle. We have to say at some point to the government, look, we know we've been attacked. We know it's impossible for the government to prevent every single attack that comes. We want you to do the best you can with the powers that you already have. We're not going to keep watering down the Constitution and conferring more and more power to the government after every single attack, because if we do that, we will have changed what America is all about. If we surrender our freedom, we've kind of like lost sight of what the whole battle was about. So that's what I was talking about in that study.
So as far as the Patriot Act goes, which amendments of the Bill of Rights have been affected, and what specifically, if you want to take some time and tell us, what specifically in that bill, which new powers are so troubling to you, and how do they affect the Bill of Rights?
Okay, there's a couple of things in the Patriot Act that impinge upon constitutional rights. There's a provision that is called or known as the sneak and peek provision, and this affects the Fourth Amendment, which protects all Americans against unreasonable searches of our homes. And what the sneak and peek provision does is it allows law enforcement agents to go into somebody's home and, well, let me back up a second. When police officers normally search your home or my home, if we're at home when they come to conduct the search, they give us the search warrant. And, or if we're not there, if we happen to be at work or somewhere else when they come to search our home, they leave the search warrant behind. And this is an important part of how the Fourth Amendment operates, because what that does is it immediately puts us on notice that the government is there or was there while we were gone. So it gives us the opportunity to, like, if you or I went back to, you know, we're both on the radio right now. If we go back to our homes and find out that the government was there and was searching the place, we're immediately put on notice that they were there so that we can go through our house to see if anything was taken, to see if anything was damaged, and to see, you know, what has changed since we left the house. Under the Patriot Act, they have this thing called the sneak and peek provision that allows law enforcement agents to go into the home to take photographs of things, maybe to copy computer disks, or to basically look around, take photographs, that sort of thing, and then leave the house without ever notifying us that they were there until maybe months later. And the problem with that, as I was alluding to before, is that if we're told months later, it really puts us in a hard spot because we weren't able to search the place to see if something was taken months ago. So if you want to file a lawsuit against the government saying that they had acted illegally or that they had abused their power by taking something that they shouldn't have or damaging something that they shouldn't have, your lawsuit is going to be a lot weaker because you didn't have the evidence that you needed to prove your case until months later. So this lack of notice provision on the Fourth Amendment is a curtailment of this Fourth Amendment safeguard that the framers put in the Bill of Rights. That's the first thing. The second thing is that under the Patriot Act, federal law enforcement agents like the FBI and other federal law enforcement agencies have been given much greater subpoena power to get educational records from colleges and universities, to get records from libraries and bookstores to find out what people have been reading, to get medical records from doctors and hospitals. They can get business records from hotels, rental car companies. They can get all of these things without having to go through the normal search warrant process. You know, the way in which the police normally have to get search warrants for documents and that sort of thing is that they have to apply to a judge and say, "Judge, you know, we want a search warrant for this stuff." And the judge then checks the police by reviewing their application. If the application is good, professional, and all that, the judge will approve it and they can go conduct a search. If the judge thinks that they have not done good investigative work, he'll deny their application, which means the search will not take place. But with these subpoena powers that the Patriot Act gives law enforcement agents, basically gives them a blank check to go up to these places like bookstores, libraries, hospitals, universities, and demand records without any judicial check on their power. So it's really a significant invasion into the privacy of Americans. And to top it all off, there's a provision in the Patriot Act dealing with this subpoena that a lot of us are referring to as the gag rule. Basically prohibits people who have been served with the subpoenas from speaking out about them. Yeah, this has gotten into the newspapers a little bit about librarians who are very upset about this. If a librarian, for example, or the owner of a bookstore has been served with a subpoena by the FBI asking for a record, that bookstore owner or librarian cannot go on a radio program like this. They cannot talk to reporters and basically say, "Well, you know, the FBI was here yesterday. You should have seen all the information that they were demanding." And so we can't, the people who have been, are being served with the subpoenas cannot speak out about them. So, and if they can't speak out about them, how do we know what the government is doing so that we can call our congressman and saying, "Well, we think, you know, you may have given them too much power with the Patriot Act," because it's all kind of kept secret. All of the abuses are going to be kept secret. So this gag rule, really raises basic free speech questions. So, Fourth Amendment protection against searches and seizures and First Amendment free speech provisions are all affected by the Patriot Act.
What about the Fifth Amendment?
Fifth Amendment is also impacted in various ways. Fifth Amendment protects people by guaranteeing them due process of law. The Fifth Amendment and the Sixth Amendment also talk about the grand jury and how the grand jury system is supposed to operate. The grand jury has subpoena powers, but the rule that's always kind of limited the power of grand juries is secrecy, so that if your records are subpoenaed by a grand jury or you're called to testify before a grand jury, that information is supposed to be kept with the grand jury. It's not supposed to be shared or disclosed. So that's a, kind of like a privacy protection there. But under the Patriot Act, prosecutors and law enforcement people who get a hold of grand jury material, in the past, if they wanted to share that information with anybody, they had to get the approval of a judge. Again, that checks and balances idea. But under the Patriot Act, they don't need a judge's approval anymore. So you can have prosecutors with the Justice Department we'll have a grand jury investigation. They'll take the information that's been gathered there, and now they can start sharing it with dozens and dozens of various federal agencies, from the U.S. Navy, Postal Inspection Service, and dozens of agencies you never heard of in the federal government can suddenly get a hold of grand jury information without it first having been approved by a federal judge. So,
what about the prosecutors in criminal cases getting intelligence information from those other agencies?
Right. That is going on, too. You see, and, you know, there's maybe some cases where that can be justified, but the protection or safeguard that we've always had up until now was that judicial check. If the prosecutors could persuade an independent judge that, look, this is the information that we have, this is why we want to share it with the intelligence agencies, you know, it might further these investigations. If the judge agrees with them, then the information can be shared. But if the judge thinks that, no, this is just not necessary, or you're trying to, this would, you know, have too much of an impact on a person's privacy and it really wouldn't further an investigation, then the judge could deny the request. So it's that important aspect of checks and balances, which the framers understood so well, that has kind of, you know, kept the government from abusing its powers. But
I think most Americans would go ahead and let them slide if the prosecutors or the Justice Department wants to give information to the CIA, which is foreign intelligence type operations. I don't think most Americans would have any problem with that, since the CIA doesn't have police power over them. I think the real question that where people eyebrows start raising is when the CIA can take whatever information that they have and share that with the domestic civilian prosecutors. Isn't the other way on that two-way street the more dangerous of the two? Having the intelligence agencies share their information with the prosecutors rather than the other way around?
I don't know. I don't know what you have in mind. If the CIA has more overseas intelligence information than the FBI. So if the CIA is, for example, able to identify Al-Qaeda people who are traveling from Afghanistan to Germany, then the CIA might want to share that type of information with the FBI if they've, like, got a wiretap or got an informant overseas who says that this particular guy is trying to get to the U.S. and is trying to get visas and he's trying to travel to the U.S. That may be, you know, an appropriate thing for the CIA to, because the CIA is not supposed to operate domestically here in the U.S., that's an example of where the CIA is properly tipping off the FBI to keep an eye out for this guy who's trying to gain entry to the United States.
Well, it has been in the past, though, that if the CIA did have information about whatever domestic criminal activity, not something connected with, for example, Al-Qaeda or something like that, but if they come upon intelligence about domestic criminal activity, in the past they haven't been allowed to just turn that over to the FBI, right? That would have to be information gained by a warrant and all that for the FBI to use it.
Right. Right. Some of these instances can get technical, and some have to be addressed on a case by case basis. That's why, again, bringing this stuff to a judge is an important check, we think, on the power of information sharing between these agencies. I think one thing that Americans need to be aware of is that whatever the rules are, we should expect that the law enforcement agencies are respecting the rules. And there have been several instances that have come up which have made it obvious that the FBI is not always abiding by the rules. To give you an example, there's a secret court in Washington called the FISA Court. It's called, the FISA stands for Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and that law sets up a FISA Court, which hears special applications for search warrants or wiretap, and the FBI agents go before the secret court and they say, well, look, where this is a foreign espionage or counter-espionage case, and we want a special wiretap warrant against, say, like a foreign embassy rather than an American citizen. There was an FBI agent who filed so many false and misleading affidavits to this court that later came to light later on, months later, that the FISA court took the extraordinary step of saying, of barring this agent from ever appearing before the court again. And that's really an extraordinary thing for a court to do, is to say, we don't ever want to see this agent in our court ever again. Don't have him file any papers.
Does he still have his job, this agent?
He does. That's what's so troubling about it. Now, if the FBI turned around and said, oh my gosh, you know, this guy's been filing false information with the secret court, and they turned around and indicted him for perjury, okay, you know, there's some accountability going on, but there has been no accountability for this agent, which really makes you begin to wonder, you know, how much these agents and the agency itself are following the rules. Because, you know, when they ask for more power, they say, well, look, we need this more power to do these certain things. But then they try to assure us that, okay, you know, although we're getting more power, you know, you can trust us. We'll abide by the new rules and everything. But if they're ignoring the rules at the same time, you know, we have to keep this sort of thing in mind, this experience in mind, when the next terrorist attack happens, you know, are we going to give them even more power? If they're ignoring the rules, and, you know, does it make sense to keep conferring more power on them? Should they be rewarded with bigger budgets and more powers when they've been abusing the powers that they already have? I don't think that makes sense.
The Navy has custody of at least two Americans right now, Hamdi and Padilla. Maybe more, as far as I know. Was that because of the Patriot Act? And also, I wonder if you could help us understand how come Hamdi and Padilla, who are both Americans arrested on American soil, are in the Navy brig, and yet Zachariah Moussaoui, the supposed 20th hijacker, who is a foreigner, gets a domestic civilian trial.
Yes, it is. It is hard to explain, but I'll do my best. But These cases do not have anything to do with the Patriot Act. These are obviously related to the war on terrorism, but there's no connection between what's going on in these cases and the Patriot Act. What has happened is we have two cases, Hamdi and Padilla. One was Hamdi, and he was initially taken into custody overseas in Afghanistan. He was then transferred to Camp X-Ray in Cuba, where they're detaining other alleged members of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. When they found out that Hamdi, when they interviewed or interrogated him, they found out that he was born in America and that he was an American citizen. When they found that out, they immediately put him on the plane and sent him to the States, where, you're right, he's being held at a naval installation in South Carolina.
And we don't really know that they picked him up in Afghanistan because they haven't had to prove that, right? They just claim that that's where they picked him up.
They claim that, but I don't think that Hamdi or his attorney is denying that at some point. But that's certainly a fair point to raise, because one of the key things going on is that he has not been allowed to meet with his attorney yet. That's one of the key issues, is that they're being held not only on military installations rather than civilian prison facilities, but they're being denied access to everybody. They're held in solitary confinement.
Didn't a New York judge demand to the Justice Department that they deliver one of these guys up before him, and they said no?
Yes, that's correct. See, there's two things going on. Padilla was the other guy. Now, he was born in America. He's an American citizen, and he was arrested at O'Hare Airport in Chicago, not overseas. And he was initially brought through the civilian court system, and then when he was about to be brought before a judge, the administration turned him over to the Department of Defense, and then he was taken to a military installation where he is being held in solitary confinement.
Now, he's the guy that the Justice Department, John Ashcroft, gave the big speech about how he was the dirty bomber, right?
That's right. That's the Padilla case. Now, a lot of Americans, you know, I talk about these cases all the time. They're very, very important cases. They have very big implications for our Constitution and for civil liberties. And a lot of Americans who I talk to, they're just like, well, what's the big deal? It's just two guys. And what's the big deal? Terrorists don't have rights anyway. I have to say
they
that
mean accused terrorists?
Yes, that's what they really mean or should know about the cases, because they are accused. They haven't been convicted yet in a court of law. Now, the thing about this that's so important is there's a lot of things going on here. We're talking about the right to counsel. We're talking about due process. We're talking about the writ of habeas corpus, which is one of the most important protections in the Constitution. Let me take just a minute to explain this, what the implications are. The writ of habeas corpus is written right in the Constitution, and the framers of our Constitution referred to it as the Great Writ. They considered it to be one of the great protections of individual liberty. And the reason why this was put in the Constitution is that generations ago, I mean, this is before the American Revolution, what they used to do, what the authorities used to do, was they used to arrest people, and then they would arrest them, put them in jail. They would never bring them to trial, because they knew once they got into court, you know, if they were arresting their political opponents, or they were just arresting people they didn't like, without really a legal basis, they knew once they got into court, a judge or a jury would throw the case out. So what they used to do was they would arrest people, put them in jail, and they would never bring them to trial. They would never bring them to trial because they knew once that happened, the person would get out. So this was kind of like a loophole in the system that they were exploiting. That's how the writ of habeas corpus came along. Writ of habeas corpus requires, writ of habeas corpus means you have the body. And the writ of habeas corpus means that a court is ordering the person who is holding the body, whether he's the policeman, the prosecutor, or the warden of the prison, he's ordering that person to bring the prisoner into court and to justify why the person is being held. If the judge agrees that there's a good reason for holding the person, that he's broken the law, and that there will be a trial, let's say in a few months, then fine, the person is taken back to his jail cell, it's all over. But if the judge finds out that there's not a good reason to hold the prisoner, you know, this is the prisoner's only opportunity to tell his side of the story to the judge. So once the judge hears both sides, if he hears from the prisoner, hears from the sheriff or the prosecutor, if the judge comes to the conclusion that there's no valid reason for locking the person up, he has the power to discharge the prisoner, to return him to his freedom. And that is why the framers considered this to be the great check on the power of government to lock people up. That's why they called it the Great Writ. Okay, now coming back to these guys, Handy and Padilla, the position of the Bush administration is they're saying that once the president decides that somebody is what they call an enemy combatant, then that person basically loses all of his rights. He can be seized, he can be taken into custody, he can be put in solitary confinement on a military installation, doesn't have the right to a lawyer, doesn't have the right to get into court. And so this is kind of like, although they don't say it, they don't say, well, we're getting rid of habeas corpus, this is the implication of their stance. They're saying it doesn't matter if the person is a citizen or a non-citizen, it doesn't matter if he's arrested overseas or on the streets of San Diego, Minneapolis, or Miami. Once the president decides that somebody is an enemy combatant, that's it. He doesn't have any rights left. Can't get into civilian court system, can't use habeas corpus, doesn't have a right to attorney, doesn't have a right to even see his own relatives. So this is a real attack on the writ of habeas corpus, and yet getting, I think, as much attention as it as serious as it is. I mean, it's getting some attention. It is being litigated right now in the courts. It's being challenged. But this is what the Bush administration is trying to do. They're trying to say that the Bush, as commander-in-chief, really can override the writ of habeas corpus. And I think this is a big, dangerous thing that he is doing.
Is there a law that he can refer to that grants him that power, or is this solely by executive order?
This is by executive order. The arguments of the Bush and his attorneys are, is that, look, the they will say that, look, we're at war, the president is commander-in-chief, and as commander-in-chief, he can do these things. So he doesn't pass, he doesn't point to a particular law. He just says, I'm the commander-in-chief, and as commander-in-chief, I can do these things. And that's their argument. I think it's a very bad one. I mean, they point to the parts of the Constitution that they like to, and they just kind of ignore the habeas corpus provision and the right to counsel and the things that you and I rely on to protect our constitutional rights. And they just ignore those things and just keep harping on Commander-in-Chief.
Besides these military or the tribunals, or even these guys, I guess, aren't even going to get tribunals. But besides that, in what other ways have the police and the military gotten closer since September 11th, as far as information sharing or even command?
Well, at this point, it's more in the discussion stage. There is a law that was passed after the Civil War called the Posse Comitatus Act, which basically keeps the military out of domestic law enforcement situations. But since September 11th, we're hearing senators and other people saying that this law is outmoded and we need to get rid of it. And they're trying to blur the differences in the missions between the military and domestic law enforcement, and we think that that's a very dangerous thing. The Posse Comitatus Act is a very wise law because the missions of the military and the police are very, very different. Yeah, they both wear uniforms, they both carry weapons, but that's where the similarities end. The military, their mission is basically to find and destroy the enemy. They're trained to inflict maximum damage on the enemy. That's not something you want in domestic law enforcement situations, because we want the police to use the absolute minimum amount of force necessary to bring suspects into a court of law. Military people aren't known for thinking of the constitutional rights of the people on the other side of the battlefield. They're trying to destroy them. And that's fine. That's what the military is all about. But when it comes to the police are encountering people that have constitutional rights, people who have the right to bear arms, people who have the right against excessive force, have rights against illegal searches, trespass, and this sort of thing. So we don't want the military coming into a domestic law enforcement situation. That's asking for trouble, and we're asking for, we think, unnecessary confrontations, and there's increased risk of unnecessary violence where there's going to be unnecessary shootings and unnecessary killings. So we want to keep these two missions separate. We don't want to see them joined together. That would be a prescription for disaster.
What can people do on the local level to preserve liberty?
They can do a couple of different things. Number one, as we discussed earlier, one thing that they can do is they can support organizations that they think are doing a good job of checking the government and defending the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. Everybody realizes that a lot of us are too busy. They've got businesses to run, families to raise. They cannot keep an eye on things that they're government is doing all the time. So one thing that they can do is support organizations that are doing a good job of doing those things. Secondly, they can always contact their representatives in Washington, their senators and congressmen, and let them know that they do not want their freedoms and their privacy surrendered in the war against terrorism. This is what the battle is all about. The terrorists want to destroy America, and what we should be focusing on is fighting back against the terrorists, but not giving up our way of life. I mean, this is what our soldiers, I think, are fighting for overseas, is they're defending our way of life. They're not just, defending the buildings and people who happen to live between Canada and Mexico. They're defending something even more important, the idea of a free society. And so we want to keep that in mind and not lose sight of that, and not let our congressmen in a blind panic throw our freedoms away. So they need to let their representatives know that. And they can also let their local officials know that, too. There are beginning to be some movements at the grassroots level where local officials are dissenting and taking some actions, not cooperating with some of the controversial provisions of the Patriot Act. All of these things help to remind the federal government that, look, you know, people are serious about wanting to retain their liberties and the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. So all of those things can help.
All right. The website is cato.org. Anybody can look up Timothy Lynch. He is the author of an article, which I can't wait to get my hands on, called Trial by Jury Isn't a Luxury. And he is the director of Cato's Project on Criminal Justice. Thank you very much, Mr. Lynch, for joining us today.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.